All right, so as we begin our trek through the minor prophets this quarter, the first one we're going to discuss is Jonah. He's not the first minor prophet as far as on the timeline is concerned. I think Greg Steele talked about the fact that, was probably Obadiah. Jonah, more than likely a contemporary with Amos. And so there are a couple of questions that I thought of whenever I started this, and one of them was, you know, why do we even want to bother to study or look at Jonah? So what's the first thought in your mind whenever you think of the book of Jonah? Right, Jonah and the whale. That's a lot of people say, right? Jonah and the big fish. So we equate this story with that, yet there are only, I think, 4 or 5 verses that's even dedicated to that portion of the story in the all 4 chapters of the book. So, as Ralph and I were saying here in the beginning, I think that we can see part of our own selves in Jonah. Have we ever been in a situation where we're unwilling to do something that we know that we should do, and then yet we've tried to run from it? And here is a classic story of Jonah trying to do that and run away from God. And we see that that's not very effective. How about, do we ever get angry about what somebody else does? Have any of us ever done that? Well, we see here that Jonah has this anger at the end. And he is then taught a lesson by God dealing with that anger. So I think that we can gain from studying this book because of those aspects of it.
Looked like Jonah was maybe trying to keep the Lord from making a big mistake.
Right. Yeah, how many of us have an idea that we probably know best, right? And that's definitely something that that I think we all have to watch, is sometimes our ideas seem to be a lot better than whatever we may be told in the Word of God or having God's will. You know, we talk a lot about, what's the purpose of baptism. We even had a discussion on that the last couple of weeks. I mean, what's the point of being dipped in water? It doesn't make a lot of sense if you just look at it from the water and being dunked under, right? But there are a lot of reasons that God has us do that, and it's very symbolic. And so we just have to do His will instead of constantly walking around trying to determine whether that makes a lot of sense to us or not. All right, so Jonah, we first learn about in 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 25. And this is the reign of Jeroboam the II. What's happening during the reign of Jeroboam the II in Israel? What's occurring there? We have widening of the borders. We have great prosperity. Okay, it's said that during Jeroboam the II's reign, if you were to combine Israel and Judah together, you would probably see the extents of that kingdom almost to what Solomon had it. Okay, so they are growing, they are prosperous, lots of good things are happening, and yet Jonah is a prophet of God during this time. So some postulate that he could have been one of the prophets that would have been talking to Jeroboam and to the people there, telling them about their prosperity, telling them about what was going to be coming, and then watching this come on along. Yet, that is not what the book of Jonah is about. He's called to do something else. He lived in a village called Gath-Hepher, and that is supposed to be close to the area of Nazareth. Okay, in Galilee. That's where many historians think that they place that. So that's approximately the area where he was in Nazareth. this time, and one of the reasons for the expansion of Israel, is a time in Assyria of exactly the opposite happening. Okay, they're in between two of their, I would say, most famous kings, or their most strategic kings, and one is Shalmaneser III, which grew Assyria greatly. Also, Tiglath-Pileser will come in about 745. This is around 800 or 790. So another 50 years or so, we have Tiglath-Pileser that comes in. And Tiglath-Pileser gets Assyria to the point where about 6 years after he leaves, or after he dies, and another Shalmaneser takes over, we are at the fall of Israel. Okay, so here we are. let's see. If it's about 790, the fall of Israel occurs in 721. We're 70 years away from Israel's complete collapse. Yet we see them prospering greatly here. So,
one thing before we get away from Jonah and his personal information regarding where he came from, some of the enemies of Jesus one time questioned his authenticity, his credentials as to whether he was really a prophet. Who ever heard of a prophet coming from Nazareth? Well, they didn't know about Jonah. They didn't know where he was from. They should have known. And they should have known where it was. It was from that area near Nazareth in Galilee.
That's right.
So they did err in not knowing the scripture.
That's correct. That's a very good point, and I think as we go through here, I've noted a couple of areas where I want to talk about that comparison of Jonah, and then how Christ uses Jonah as well as a couple of things that he says. But that ties really into the next question of, there's really three approaches to the book of Jonah, and there's people that say, did this really happen? And I think it was Haley's commentary that pointed out, there's really only three ways that you can approach it. It's either completely mythical, right? Or it's completely allegorical, or it's historical, right? It's fact. So what, some would say, well, this was just something that had happened in the past, and there are the Hebrews passed down the story. It kind of grew over time, and it was embellished, and just kind of became, started out as kind of a myth and a good story, and now all of a sudden it rolls into this truth, which it really never was. The allegorical look, of course, is something that says, well, let's look at the way Israel has been, and now it's seeing prosperity. So we can look at the entire book of Jonah, through a lens that says, well, that's like Israel. We were bad, we repented, good things happened, right? That's the allegory argument. But why is it that we take it historical? And we see in the New Testament several verses that Jesus himself uses Jonah, and the way he uses those references are not in a historical, are not in an allegorical or mythical way, but they are acting as if it were truth and fact. And this also tells us that the book of Jonah was used in the old Hebrew book of law that they would have had around. So let's flip over to Matthew, the 12th chapter, verses 39-41. It's a time when the scribes and the Pharisees are asking for a sign. And in 38, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." But he answered and said to them, An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because they repented after the preaching of Jonah, and indeed a greater than Jonah is here. So that's it's a pretty telling statement whenever you're talking to the scribes and the Pharisees, those who are ones who really are to know the law, and you're telling them they're going to be judged by these men and women of Nineveh. In verse 6, in chapter 16, 1 through 4, they're also testing him again, still wanting a sign. And it says, when it's evening, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it will be foul weather today, for the sky is, for the sky is red and threatening. Hypocrites, you know how to discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the time. A wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign shall be given to it except for the sign of the prophet Jonah. And he left them and departed. Luke, also chapter 11, 29 through 32. I think that's a parallel to the first one that we read in Matthew. It's yet once again they're seeking a sign, and in verse 32, the men of Nineveh will rise up in judgment with this generation and condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and indeed a greater than Jonah is here. So we see that Jesus' references back to Jonah at least tell me that this is a historical fact and not something that would be drawn out of a myth or an allegory of what happened in Israel. So I think that as I begin to read through this, my mind is drawn to a psalm in Psalm 139. If you would turn over there, we'll read some verses out of that. But in Psalm 139, we can look at this idea of trying to flee the presence of God. And it's somewhat ironic because in the second chapter of Jonah, whenever he does pray, he references a lot of the Psalms. We can see a lot of the Psalms coming through in his prayer. Yet, here in Psalms 139, beginning in verse 7, it says, "Where can I go from your spirit, or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall fall on me, even the night shall be light about me. Indeed, the darkness shall not hide from you. But the night shines as the day, the darkness and the light are both alike to you. For you formed my inward parts, you covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearful and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet uniformed, and in your book they were all written, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them. How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God! How great is the sum of them! If I should count on them, they would be more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with you." So, as I read this and I think on the fact that, I mean, it sounds like to me almost that Jonah could have written part of that. You can't hide from God. God made us, and no matter where we are, He will be there. So, That's kind of my thoughts as I start into here. An overview of the book of Jonah tells us that we see in chapter 1 that Jonah receives this call, and then he runs. And we see him on the ship. We see him being cast into the sea. And the very last verse there, we see that there's a fish prepared for him. Chapter 2 is his prayer while he's in the belly of this fish. And we see some of his thoughts while he's there. And then the very last verse, he spit back out. He's vomited up onto dry land. In chapter 3, we have a call again. We don't know what the time difference is between the time that he spit out on the dry land and he receives that second call. But we know that he receives the second call. And now he goes and he preaches in the city of Nineveh. We see their repentance. And in chapter 4, we begin to deal with this anger that Jonah has. And then we see God's mercy as he relents and as he teaches Jonah a lesson concerning this. So let's go to Jonah, begin in chapter 1. So we start out, we can identify Jonah as being the one in 2 Kings because they're both listed as the son of Midi. And he's told to go and arise and cry out against it. So go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it. For their wickedness has come up before me. Now, does Jonah then begin to argue with God about what a bad idea this is? He just runs the opposite way. Yeah. I see this, and I couldn't help but think about, it's in Matthew, the 21st chapter, verses 28 through 32, and Jesus tells the parable of the two sons. Remember that? The father tells one of them, walks up to one of them and says, I need you to help me in the vineyard. What was the response? Yeah, okay. Then he goes to the other one. Need you help me in the vineyard? What was the response?
No,
can't do it. And then what happens?
Just
the Ryan. They both. One just said yes, seemingly to just say, that way he'll just leave me alone, right? He'll think I'm coming, and when I don't come, I'll make up some excuse later. But the other one starts to regret it and actually does come. And Jesus' question at the end of that is, so which one obeyed, right?
Eventually, the one who did what he was supposed to.
That's right. Didn't matter that his answer initially was no. He did obey. So, even the scribes and the Pharisees could figure that one out, right? Yet here we have Jonah, who doesn't there's no reply recorded. There's nothing that's recorded about this. He just gets up and he's going to head out of town, right? He goes down to Joppa, gets on a ship. He's going to Tarshish, okay? This would be what would be known as basically the edge of the Western world at this time. Tarshish is on the Rock of Gibraltar area where the Atlantic Ocean opens into the Mediterranean Sea. And Africa and Europe are at their closest points there. So he's getting away. How effective was that move?
He didn't get there.
He didn't get there, did he? He absolutely didn't get there. So he gets on this boat, though, and there's quite a storm that kicks up. And where is Jonah?
Down the bottom of the ship
asleep. Now, I read several different comments on this, but I guess I would say I can imagine the turmoil and the emotional drain that this would be trying to run away from God. And yet he is on the ship. And so he is down in the belly of this ship. Running and running, and now he's exhausted. Yet there's quite a storm that's come up, and the sailors are trying to figure out what to do. They start throwing their cargo overboard to lighten the ship so it can sit higher in the seas. And it says in verse 5 that every man cried out to his God. That is lowercase God, right? They are trying to figure out what is going on. They're calling upon the aid of someone else. And eventually, as we get to verse 6, the captain goes down and he looks, finds Jonah, and he wakes him up. And his first words are, "Arise, call on your God. Perhaps your God will consider us, so that we may not perish." And so they bring him up on to the top, probably, and here they're going to cast lots because they've got to figure out who has brought this problem on them. Okay? So they cast lots. We're not sure exactly how that would have occurred, but somehow, however they did it, that lot falls upon Jonah. And Jonah now gets the opportunity to teach each one of these men who he worships and who his God is. But we see in verse 8, they cast lots, and in verse 8, it's just a litany of questions. You can almost see, you know, 5 or 6 people standing around and asking him all these questions at once. What are you doing? Why are you here? You know, What do you do? Where do you come from? What's your country? You know, what, you know, tell me. There's something here that's going to explain to me why we're in this situation that we're in. And so so his response is, "I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." Now that response right there strikes some significant fear into those who are listening to them, and I think it as it should. You know, their gods that they would have worshipped would have been things like gods of the sun or gods of the trees or whatever. But yet he declares that the God that he worships is the one who has created all this and has control over all this.
God had a selection. Had a hand in the selection. Jonah being the problem when they cast the lot.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think we see several times this lot being cast, right? And each time, whenever it is cast and recorded for us, we can certainly see the hand of God in that. Lots were even cast in the choosing of the land among the children of Israel, after they've taken portions of it, and some of the families were choosing what lots that they were to take. So, we can see a miracle occurring here, and the right person being identified through this. they're wanting to know, what can they do? What can we do to solve this problem? Because they're in fear of dying on this ship. And his response is to throw me over. Okay? Their immediate response to that is they don't want to do that, because we see them rowing desperately to try to get back to land. And they finally get to the point where they realize, we don't have an option, right? We're going to have to throw this man over. Now, what do they do when they reach that point?
Hey, it's God that he might not hold them responsible.
That's right. So here, we don't want the we don't want the blood of Jonah to be on our heads. Now, this reminds me of something that occurs in the New Testament and what a difference that is. These are heathen sailors, right? And they don't want the blood of Jonah to be on their head. Yet we have a crowd of Jewish leaders and those who have come to worship, right? And yet, what do they cry out whenever Jesus is, they want him to be crucified? Let him be on our heads. That's right. So, what a contrast we have here to have these heathen sailors that are like, you know, we're going to throw him over because that's what he said to do, but we don't want that to be on our heads. Please, you know, don't count that against us. Yet we see an entire nation willing to take the blood of Christ on their own head and the heads of their children. So they cast him over the side, and what happens? Yeah, just stops. Now, what kind of an impression does that leave?
There's something in what this man said.
That's correct, right? There is some significant, you know, truth into what is going on here. And we see them sacrifice and make vows. We don't know what that all leads to, but we see them sacrifice and make vows. And I also think, what kind of a story is this going to tell whenever they get back to land, right? You think they probably all just said, ooh, we're not going to tell anybody about that. Now, I have a feeling that story spread very rapidly. I don't know that I would have been able to keep my mouth shut about that. And so here we have some men, I think, you know, taught by the fact that Jonah has run away from God, and they see God and the power that he has. So, as we end this chapter, and we begin into chapter 2, we see that the Lord has prepared this great fish. A lot of it's translated as fish. You know, commentators will say in the Hebrew and in the Greek, it's talking about some kind of a sea monster, and which is kind of a generic statement. So I think that a great fish is an adequate statement. We're going to use the term fish throughout the day here. He is now swallowed by this fish. Okay? And in chapter 2, we're going to look at this prayer that he has and some of the aspects of it. He begins, I'll say this, as you read through the prayer here, I think you can tell that it is a retrospective look back on to what he was thinking when he was there. Obviously, he was not, you know, with pen and ink while he was in the belly of this fish recording this for us, but this is a reflective look back on what occurred and some of the things that he would have had and some of the thoughts that he would have had. So in verse 2, we see him crying out to the Lord. It says that he was in the belly of Sheol. Okay? This was, you know, the unseen parts. And here he is in the unseen parts. Verse 3, we go on down, is cast into the deep. He is not in a place that... That I guess any man has ever been that has come back and told us about. This is all new. And I was reading online trying to research a picture because I think this third point here, he was cast out of the sight of God is the second point. In verse 4 it says, I have been cast out of your sight. Yet we still know, even from reading Psalm 139 and then what Jonah has tried to do, is he ever out of God's sight? No. But in verse 5, and this is what actually got me to start thinking, and I was looking around on the internet, and I've seen pictures before, I'm sure we all have, of some, you know, big whale, and Jonah sitting inside in the stomach, right? He's got a little fire going, he's sitting there next to it, the smoke's coming out through the blowhole in the top, you know, and he's... You know, I remember seeing that as a child, and you know, kind of chuckling at the time. But then, if you read verse 5, and you see the situation that he was in, this was not, you know, a small apartment, right? He is in the bowels of this fish. It says, "The water surrounded me even to my soul. The deep closed around me. Weeds were wrapped around my head." Okay. He is not comfortable. And I think his every thought was probably, this is probably going to be about it. In verse 7 we see, "My soul fainted within me. I remembered the Lord, and my prayer went up to you into your holy temple."
I was watching a TV program on Discovery Channel, I think, where they try to explain all the miracles of the Bible and some natural phenomena, you know, that could make it possible. And they said no man would be able to live that long in the belly of a fish. And but they got the whole thing, just what you just said, that he prayed. And it was God's will that it happened, and it was a miracle. And yeah, it wouldn't happen under natural circumstances, but because God used this means to save Jonah and to teach him a lesson, so this is was possible. And how do we know that? By faith.
Right.
So God prepared a great fish. He made a fish that was had such characteristics as a person could get inside of it and survive. It didn't.
Right.
Wasn't eaten up by the stomach acid or anything like that. Some have said, well, a whale's stomach is not big enough to hold a man or something.
Right.
That's, of course, it doesn't, in this Bible, it doesn't even use the word whale now.
Right.
The
right.
Earlier ones have used that term, at least I think in the New Testament.
Reference back, right.
But even in this one, it speaks of the great fish.
Matthew 12:40 refers to it, though, as the whale.
This one it calls a great fish.
Right, and the actual Greek of Matthew 12:40 is tied back to this idea of a great sea creature. And so you've had liberties of those who have interpreted it, trying to say, well, a great sea creature would be a plank, you know, whale or some sort.
In a natural situation, that's what people would think of. The biggest thing they could
absolutely imagine. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we try to put our own, you know, our logic can only go so far. Yes, ma'am.
I was just saying, you know, so often we hear people say that the God of the New Testament is different from the God of the Old Testament. And we see in the Law of Moses the idea of instant punishment for sin and that sort of thing. But in the story of Jonah, we see God's long suffering and his willingness to forgive when Jonah turned back to him and prayed to him, the same way he offered to Israel over and over and over again that he would take them back. And so for him to leave Jonah there alive until he had the opportunity to pray and turn back to God and then to deliver him is very much the picture that we have of the God of the New Testament as well.
That's right. That's a very good point. And, you know, as I was poking around the internet trying to find this picture, I ran across a site that was a site based on atheism. And one of the key, you know, seems like stories that they just love to go to, is, you know, to just completely disprove the Bible and anything in it, is this one. Right? I mean, this is ridiculous. And they look specifically at this in the belly of the fish for 3 days and 3 nights. And then they start pointing out everything that man has to have. Well, he can't have oxygen because he's in the belly of the fish. He can't. He's in the stomach juices and he would be digested and torn up. And, you know, know, it's not going to, he can't live there. He's got to have so much water a day, right? And there's not potable water inside of the belly of some fish. So, you know, so any of these would kill him in a matter of hours, yet, you know, as their hypothesis is.
And they think of all the miracles in some natural phenomenon that would be possible or not possible.
Right.
And they don't understand that if it's God's will and he made it happen.
That's right.
It's possible.
Yeah, and I always go back to the fact is, you know, they want to explain that by all these you know, using their own logic, yet I've yet to see anybody explain creation using some logic. Right?
Well, they're trying.
That second law of thermodynamics is killing them, though.
Yeah. You know? They have a series on television.
Yeah.
The Earth was made.
That's right. Oh, it's, yeah, I sit there and the amount of effort and energy that is put into trying to make this all happen scientifically from something, yet they still can't describe how something started, right? So, you know, here the argument is made, and, you know, if you want to not believe the Bible, then I guess this would be a good story to go to and just say it's ridiculous. But there are too many things that we know about God that tell us, you know, 3 days and three nights in the belly of a fish without oxygen, without water, without all that. Okay.
That's a miracle.
That's a miracle.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And so he preserved Jonah, and Jonah was able to eventually come around and through God's long suffering and his mercy, he allows him to be spit out, vomited out. In verse 10, the Lord spoke to the fish and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. I think there's a, you know, up to this point, we'll see even more, but up to this point, we see God's hands in several things. One, the sea, right? The storm that he's brought up, and now over this fish, right? And so, God's hand, he is in control of all that is happening here. And yet, we have a man who thought that he could run away from it. All right, so then we begin chapter 3.
You know, Jonah's idea of not wanting to go to Nineveh to teach these Gentiles or save these Gentiles is understandable, being a Jew, because with Peter had gone and preached to the centurion, if God hadn't told him to, if he hadn't,
that's right,
made his will known to him, would he have gone as a Jew?
We see the exact same attitude. One, I think, that we have to continue ourselves to watch.
They didn't understand that the gospel was going to be for the Jews and the Gentiles.
That's right. And this is one of the key prophets of the Old Testament. This is not a prophet prophesying to Israel or a prophet prophesying to Judah. This is one that's going to go outside. And we see, I think Greg mentioned it last week, we see this idea that you know, God is concerned and has expectations for all the nations, not just that of Judah and Israel. So we're going to have to move pretty quick. But in chapter 3, we see that he's called again. And now he's told to go preach to Nineveh, the message that he tells him.
In the other prophets, we have specifics of what God says concerning. Here we don't.
We don't.
We just, so it's basically the story of Jonah. And the things that we learn from it, not the message.
Right. But we see that he has a completely different reaction now. Like you said, we don't know how long it took from the vomiting up on the dry land to this chapter, but I suggest it wouldn't have been years, but it could have been a certain amount of time, because we're told that he's called again. He then walks into the city, And he begins to proclaim the fact that they have 40 days and they're going to be overthrown. And it's noted that they repent. But they didn't just say, "Ooh, we're really sorry about that." They had action, okay? They went, they put on sackcloth, ashes. It went all the way to the top, didn't it? The king made a declaration to the nation. And he had them even do that to the animals. Okay? So a time, they would do this at times if they were, you know, extremely sorrowful or in mourning of some sort. And so they really, they not only said that they were sorry about what they had done, but they made actions that showed God how they were truly sorry. This kind of goes back to, you know, faith and works, right? They weren't saved because of their action. They repented and they had action that showed their repentance. They were spared here at this time. Now we'll get to Nahum later in this quarter and we'll see when they aren't spared. So that is a temporary thing. But in chapter 4, I think the most telling part of the entire book of Jonah is here we see Jonah, he's mad. And what's his response? "I just knew you'd do this, God. I knew it. That's exactly why I went the other way." Right? You know, so now he's mad because God is showing mercy and kindness and long-suffering. But what did Jonah have to have in the second chapter just to make it to this point?
Those exact illustration.
That's right. So here he is upset that God is willing to extend this, and I think exactly what some of y'all said earlier, to this heathen nation. See, they're the Hebrews, right? They're the Jews. They're God's chosen people. But yet these Assyrians, thorn in the side the whole time, right? I'm glad they're having problems right now. We're growing. We're prospering. We are your people. Yet these people, you know, if they just go away, that'd be fine with me. That's the attitude.
They were cruel, known to be a cruel and evil people.
Absolutely. There were stories of them killing women and children, as well as the men of certain cities, and lopping off their heads and leaving piles of their heads by the road. I think that would be a deterrent to rebel against Assyria, right?
But they repented.
But they repented. That's right. So Jonah, you know, God responds back and says, you know, "Is it right?"
Verse 4,
thank you. "Is it right for you to be angry?" After this anger, this little temper tantrum, I'd call it. And so Jonah then goes outside the city. He's going to sit down. He builds himself a little booth, right? He's going to sit down. What's he going to do? "I'm going to wait. Got 40 days. We're going to see if you change your mind," right? So he sits out there and he wants that city to go away. He wants to see them make their first mistake so that they can tell God. Hey, right? There they go. God, we see this whole idea of God preparing a plant. Comes up overnight. Then he sends a worm that eats it. This wind from the east. And now Jonah gets so upset about this going away. And yet, Jonah had nothing to do with any of this here. And yet he's super mad about that. Yet, he wants this whole nation, this capital city. And God states and tells us there are 120,000 people that can't even tell their right hand from their left, referring probably to children that don't even know the difference there. "You want me to destroy the city that there are 120,000 people that can't even make a discernment as simple as that. And yet you're so angry about this little bitty plant that you had nothing to do with." So that's the book of Jonah. Sorry, I wish we'd have gotten a little bit more time in the end there. But appreciate your attention and comments.